capitalism is never without resistance, and the commons provides a safe haven of resistance, a place to reproduce our energies, to talk and consult with comrades.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the show today. That voice you just heard was historian Peter Limbaugh talking about the commons. We're going to hear more from him because our program today is devoted to the idea of the commons, which are places that are not privately owned and function outside the market. They are places that give us a taste of another way of organizing our society and sustain us in our efforts to bring about a better world. KBOO is a commons, which is just one more reason to support the radio station. We are now in our fall drive and hope to raise $55,000. You can contribute by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by clicking on Donate on your KBOO app. Help keep community radio alive in Portland. Today on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we bring you a broadcast from Against the Grain. Sasha Lilly speaks with Peter Limbaugh about the history of the commons, the importance of the commons as areas of rejuvenation and resistance, what the commons have to do with communism, and more. Against the Grain is a weekly radio show hosted and produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song on KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. It's a program of ideas, in-depth analysis, and commentary on political, economic, social, and cultural issues important to radical thinking and activism. Here's Sasha Lilly with historian Peter Limbaugh.
Today on Against the Grain, what is the relationship between things held in common, from rivers and forests to traditions of sharing and mutual aid, and communism? How should we understand the connection between the commons within class society and life after capitalism? Historian Peter Limbaugh weighs in on the history of the idea of communism, the very different history of enclosure, and the influence of the commons and egalitarian indigenous ideas on the work of Karl Marx. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The commons has come into a kind of vogue in recent decades as mainstream thinkers have recognized the value of protecting land or ecosystems from the market. But to historian of the commons Peter Limbaugh, the commons are synonymous with resistance to class society and a striving for life beyond it. Limbaugh is the author of numerous books, including Red Round Globe Hot Burning and The Many-Headed Hydra. I should disclose my own connection to PM Press, which has published works by Peter Limbaugh. I had the opportunity to speak to him about the relationship of the commons to the idea of communism and how fights against the enclosure of the commons, along with the ideas of the Haudenosaunee, influenced Marx and Engels. I began by asking Peter Limbaugh how we should understand the role of the commons under capitalism.
Capitalism is never without resistance, and the commons provides a safe haven of resistance, a place to reproduce our energies, to talk and consult with comrades. I think it's important for us to see the commons, or commoning, is already here, and it's easier to see where capitalism is less strong than in the U.S., less intense. Capitalism is so saturated, the U.S., but this is less true elsewhere. So the commons, as Silvia Federici has pointed out, is a really decisive creation of women in struggle throughout Latin America and Africa. There is a long-term association of women and the commons. And when I say this, I'm speaking as a man who grew up in a patriarchal society and where they talk about mankind as if that meant everybody. But I have to think consciously that even in the Bible, you know, you might know that the priestly codes always said, don't be too efficient in your harvesting. Make sure you leave something left over for the orphan, the widow, and the stranger. But there's a whole Bible story about Ruth, who is a gleaner. And she had access, she treated private property as a gleaner, as something that was common, that there was a common right to glean. So we need to think of the commons also as a power, as a right, not just as a place or as a resource. And when we say a power or a right, we begin to see that the commons consists of commoning. It consists of people whose activities create a commons.
You write that there have been three great waves of enclosure, starting with the 16th century and then followed by the enclosures of the 18th century and then ones that we are experiencing beginning in the late 20th century. Can you tell us about those three waves and what drove or has driven each of them in turn?
Yeah, that's quite a challenge, and it's one that we need to accept. And so I'll try, but in doing this, Sasha, I'm conscious that the thought of others is extremely important. But the reason why this question is so important is we need to historicize the period that we live in. And only by doing that does the future become possible. So we need to know where we've come from. And you've mentioned these three phases. These three phases apply to European, particularly English history. So I'm not speaking of phases in the history of people from other continents before colonization, indigenous people. I'm speaking of, as it were, indigenous people in England. And by the 16th century, those people are severely divided between a rapacious ruling class of soldiers and warriors who call themselves aristocrats, who claim to own the land. I'm referring to the Tudor dynasty, whose concluding monarch was Elizabeth I at Shakespeare's time. And that monarchy began with Henry VII and Henry VIII, and the whole world knows about Henry VIII because he was a murderous, misogynist killer, not just of his wives, but also of those who he disagreed with, such as William Tyndale, the first translator of the Bible into English, whom he had burnt, and 78,000 others he hanged by the neck at different gallows. The Tudor times, the land was enclosed by the dissolution of church property, monastic property, which had been in many ways cooperative and collective property. It also opened up to buying and selling a land market, and turned England basically into a land market. So a new class of people, the gentry, appeared, whose approach to the land was one to profit from it in money, to buy and sell the land. And this entailed fencing it or hedging it or ditching it, but putting up boundaries so that others, such as Ruth, who I mentioned earlier, that is women and children, could no longer glean in those fields, or many other common rights, such as allowing a cow to or sheep to graze or to eat the stubble. All of these common rights and forms of commoning were enclosed by the land market. So that's the first epoch, and what it did is it produced a huge proletariat. And this proletariat, they were called sturdy rogues or beggars or vagabonds, and state terror sought to protect the privatization of what had used to be common properties. And they did so with the first big criminal statutes against robbery, housebreaking, and other forms of larceny. So there's the beginning of the criminal code and also the beginning of colonization, right at the tail end of the Tudor period, where colonization for England begins in Ireland, and then from Ireland across the oceans to the Caribbean, and then to North America. And that's a process that advances in the following century, you know, in the time of the Stuarts, to speak dynastically. And it's also undergoes a huge change in the nature of the proletariat, which now includes those Irish people who have been thrown off the land, Scots people who have been expropriated from the Highlands. And by the 18th century, there's a new class that joins the aristocratic warrior class, and this is a landlord class associated, they associate itself with the Enlightenment. And they develop legal theories, philosophical theories, justifying the conquest of indigenous people elsewhere, in Africa, in North America, in South America. So this period of enclosure is conducted by Parliament, no longer just by the king, but now Parliament, and it does so with particular acts. Thousands of them were passed, parish by parish. These are called enclosure acts, and what they do is they remove the commons, they remove common rights to use the fields. I should say at this stage, there is a parallel development within cities where guilds and handicrafts undergo a change as well. They also are enclosed, but not behind hedges and fences, rather behind walls, brick walls. And this occurs while the handicraftsperson is separated from his or her means of production and materials of production. But it's not without resistance. So the handicrafts people of the cities wish to retain some common rights and usages or perquisites within their work, since they themselves produce products that the ruling class consumes. So this brings us to this second big period of the enclosure of English, Irish, and Scottish lands. It's now linked with conquest abroad, so that the conquest of and colonizations, the birth of settler colonialism, is also fundamentally an expropriation of people from their commons. But now that commons consists of indigenous people, sometimes on rare occasions in association with poor settlers, or with slaves, or with indentured servants. So you get the beginning of a three-part alliance of poor people within the proletariat, abstractly or universally considered. That is, former artisans, now indentured servants, African slaves, and indigenous peoples. This brings us, you know, through the 19th century, as at least here in North America, or Turtle Island, as I like to say, just because the indigenous designation of this geography is so much older than the USA as a designation, which is, even though it's politically, even though it's the politics that we have now, it's not the politics that's always been. USA is just, you know, a couple centuries old, give or take a decade. No, so our future, if we look back to the commons beforehand, you know, we need to rethink our geography, we need to rethink production, we need to rethink reproduction, and all of this puts us back in the commons of yore, you know, of the past. Of course, there's a danger of romanticizing, which the ruling class always says to commoners, oh, it's pie in the sky, oh, you're idealizing things. And it's quite true that the romantic movements, you know, whether you think of transcendentalists or you think of the English romantic poets, all of them tended to denigrate or ignore the actual resistance of commoners, and instead to produce idealist visions. But let us not go the other direction. There is so much within common life, the commons in the past, that is strange to us now. And like I began with one, that women were central to it. So the commons was not patriarchal or patrilinear, nor was it matrilinear or matrilocal or matriarchal. And it would differ in different places, you know, whether you're speaking of the Kurdish highlands or speaking of Indonesian forests. You know, the kin relations and social relations are different. But what's the same is that the means of production are not considered resources for the production of profiteering and profit. So this, let's say, takes us to our period, where the commons is first of all a recognition of the rights of indigenous people. And here I'd like to welcome a tremendous statement that comes out of the Red Nation, you know, here in North America, a political group called the Red Nation that follows Standing Rock, where they say that the commons is inseparable from indigeneity. And indigeneity, or the struggle for land back, which is also a struggle to protect the waters, it's also the struggle to revere Mother Earth. It's a struggle, of course, against the climate poisoning of, quote, capitalist civilization, or the industrial civilization of carbon and fossil fuels. So our period is advanced by the rights of indigenous people. It's advanced by the co-ops and neighborhood and communal kitchens of Latin America and of the great cities like Jakarta or the shack dwellers of Cape Town. It arises from necessity. Then here, so there's another aspect of the commons in this third period, our contemporary period. And then here in Turtle Island, there are many new forms of commoning that are also being essayed, are being experimented, are being tried. In fact, I would say our period now should be characterized as a period of experimentation, of finding and working out different forms of commoning for our subsistence. Our subsistence needs, our relationship to the land, our relationship to production, above all, our relationship to reproduction. I realize that these three phases, I tend to see them chronologically, but one might also see them and describe them in other terms, thematically or politically. And that's where I think we need to work, and I need to work more. There's a tutor period. There's a period of the where the force of arms encloses, where the separation, the destruction of the church, independent power of the church, moving into the 18th century. That's the period they sometimes call it the bourgeois revolutions, you know, the American and French revolutions, both of which were devoted also to destruction of the commons. I think, remember James Wilson? He's the smartest and most erudite of all the, quote, founding fathers of the U.S. Constitution. He deliberately, self-consciously, and actually argued in favor of privatization against commoning in any of its forms. So the U.S. Constitution is based on this antithesis to the commons, to its destruction.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the hour. Did you know that KBOO gets 80% of its operating funds from listeners like you? That means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship, which means that you'll hear programming on KBOO, like this rebroadcast from Against the Grain, that you will never hear on commercial radio. Please lend us a hand by giving a one-time donation, becoming a member, or if you're already a member, increasing your monthly donation. You can do all that by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or clicking on Donate in your KBOO mobile app. And thanks to all our listeners who have donated in the past. Now, back to Sasha Lilly and Peter Linebaugh.
Historian Peter Linebaugh is my guest. We're talking about the commons and communism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've been describing these different phases, especially as they relate to the Anglo world, of enclosure of the commons, including a sort of accelerated enclosure that started in the late 20th century. And you've also been describing that it's not just simply a one-way street, that there's not attempts to push back as well. But if commons can exist within capitalism, and in fact, enclosing the commons is a key part of capitalism, would it be fair to say that communism spells the end of capitalism, leading to the question, how should we think of the relationship between the commons and communism?
Yeah, this is a really important subject. If communism means the end of capitalism, I think we can also say that it will be produced from the commoning that takes place now within and against capitalism, that we are in the midst of this struggle. Communism as a political practice, as a form of state power, is not what I've been working on. I think it's important for us to make a clear separation between the nationalization of private property and its socialization. I mean, at the moment, private property, which is just another term for capital, capital is, people will want to say, like the Labour Party did of Great Britain, we need to nationalize that property. But actually, what we want to do is to socialize it. That is, to put it in the hands of those whose labors produce it. And so that's a theme that one can find in Marx, to be sure, but was developed, at least in English terms, by William Morris, who lived at about the same time as Marx, maybe a couple decades older than the grand old man. They both were bearded men, though I hesitate to call Marx a white man, because the Albanians, when they produced his books, they put on the cover a very dark, a very brown portrait of Marx in order to appeal to the people of the color of the earth, or, you know, back at the time of colonial liberation struggles in the 1960s. And there's much truth to this, that Marx came from a family that was African, North African Jews, via Portugal and Amsterdam. But that's his, like, genealogical lineage.
And was called the Moor, right?
Yeah, that's why his family members and so on called him the Moor. Actually, at the end of his life, he returned to Africa. He returned to Algeria because he had the smog and coal dust of industrial civilization had so ruined his lungs that he thought he could find fresher air in Algeria. And so that's where he went. And at the risk of a digression, in Algeria, he found Algerian forms of commoning and wrote about it with some excitement. And in fact, the Algerian commons had been defended by a revolt in Algeria, the Kabylie revolt, led by Sheikh Mokrani, at the very same time as the Paris Commune in 1871. So this is just a way of recognizing that communism appeared in the European proletariat in Paris in 1871 with the women's committees to run the city, with the abolition of the death penalty. Those were the first steps of communism during the Paris Commune, at the very same time that Algerian peasantry, farmers, and poor people were defending their forms of commoning against a French military. So this is a coincidence in time that may point to us two different forms of the commons. One, European and familiar to our Western curricula that we're taught, and the other, an indigenous third world form of the commons. And, you know, eventually these two forms of commoning will join. On one level, that's a project for scholars and historians and people, you know, who listen carefully to their grandparents. And on the other hand, it's something that is created by refugees, that's created by people on a move, that's created by migrants from one part of the world to another, who bring their experiences with them. And generally, these experiences are of mutuality, not of privatization and greed, notwithstanding the ideological promotion of the United States as a center of greed, which they call the land of opportunity. But it's opportunity for opportunists.
Peter, what do you think as a historian of the idea that you could put a date on the origin of communism as a concept?
Oh, as an idea or concept, I was always taught it went back to Plato. You know, this is what they taught us in the 1950s and in the history of political theory classes. No, there was a great political theorist in Cornell named George Sabine. And I think it was from his books that I learned that communism begins with Plato, maybe even in Plato's Republic. That's the idea of having equality of goods among all people. Communism as a word, though, we can date pretty precisely to 1840 in Paris and then quickly in London. It followed. So it really arose in discussions that had begun in the French Revolution with such people as Gracchus Babeuf, who was guillotined after his family was starved during the crises of the French Revolution. He advocated economic equality. He advocated a land back to those who work it. Gracchus Babeuf was his name. And he also believed in the insurrectionary possibilities of a urban proletariat joined with peasant, here I'm going to use a French word, émeutes, a word I use because it's related to our word of emotion, that the emotions of our passions are related to the motions of our legs and our bodies. And for the French peasantry, this was a major part of their resistance to enclosure that brought about the French Revolution. So I think the word has its origins precisely in 1840, but it also comes from a discussion of those ideas that goes back to the French Revolution. And then the idea of communism has this old, you know, old background, which we can see in scriptures, we can see it in Thomas More's Utopia, and it goes back to Plato, it goes back earlier than that, I dare say. I just don't know the history of it yet.
Historian Peter Linebaugh is my guest. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Peter Linebaugh about the notion of the commons and communism and the intersection between the two. Peter Linebaugh is the author of many books, including The London Hanged and Red Round Globe, Hot Burning. So communism, while it predates him, is associated with Marx more than any other individual. And I wanted to ask you about how Marx's ideas were shaped by his early awareness and political outrage, where he lived in Prussia as a young man, of the enclosure that was taking place, of the rights of vineyard workers to gather wood.
I'd love to tell you about that. Karl Marx said that his ideas of economics and his critique of political economy was inspired and impelled by the theft of wood in the forests of the Rhineland, a part of Germany, in the 1830s. And he wrote about this in 1842. Marx himself was a young man in his early 20s. I would recommend Raoul Peck's fine film called The Young Karl Marx. It opens with a dashing and powerful cavalry charge in the woods by the industrialists and big forest owners against poor people, against old guys, against ragged people, against women and against children. So that gives you a vivid opening of this. And it's so important because Karl Marx said that this is what put him on the track of studying political economy. And, you know, the whole world knows that the Communist Manifesto of 1848 says that the history of hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle. Well, here's the class struggle that fell into the face of Karl Marx. Not that he was amongst those who were being trodden under the hooves of the cavalry in the forests, but rather he was appalled at the legislatures who were criminalizing what had been an ancient right to fallen woods, or as we say now, windfalls in the forest. You know, as everybody knows, even city dwellers, if there's any trees on their block, that after a windstorm, there, you know, lots of twigs and small branches and, you know, heaven forbid, whole trees that fall down, crushing houses and whatnot. But the others is gathered up, and people used it for the following purposes: fuel for cooking, fuel for warmth, building materials to repair part of your structure, of your your house or your shack. Also, access to medicinal plants. These are some of the gifts of the forest. A whole other one is a source of protein, because you can put your livestock into the forests. You know, the pigs love acorns and beech mast, and to have a pig is to have protein for a family for the winter. So the forest has its whole community that is not yet privatized, or is not yet, but when it becomes privatized, which happened in the 1830s in Germany, the wood became lumber or timber. That is, it was shipped down the Rhine, now on steam engines in tugboats, you know, hauling barges, hauling timber, which was then, you know, taken to world markets for, you know, Dutch shipbuilding or building of slums in Manchester. These were the destinations of the wood in the Rhineland that formerly had been used by commoners, by common people. And this, when I first came upon this, and as your listener can do easily by reading the young Karl Marx's articles on this subject, I thought it was a rather antiquated detail of history without much importance. But now, I just think the opposite. I mean, I live here in Michigan, and Michigan once was a part of the world that was covered with trees. And those trees have all gone now. They're the hardwoods of the residences of Chicago, of Detroit. That's what happened to the wood here. And I dare say elsewhere where listeners live, whether it's California or New York State or outside the U.S. in Canada or Mexico, there's a similar story of cutting down the forests. The usos y costumbres of the usages and customs of towns and ejidos and villages of Mexico also had this access to wood. And what I learned was, as a historian, that this was a fundamental part of the Magna Carta and the ancient charters of liberty of England. Usually we think of them as prohibiting torture or guaranteeing habeas corpus, but they also guaranteed panage and estovers. Estovers derives from a French term, but what it means is access to, customary access to wood in the forest, whether it's windfalls rather, or old timber, would be negotiated locally. But in general, estovers meant a right and power to gather wood in the forests. So these were economies that were based on these huge plants, namely trees, the forests of the world, the places of Robin Hood, the places of many spirits, the places of, even now, that supply the world with the air we breathe. So I'm looking now at Marx's early work, where he doesn't refer, get this, Sasha, he doesn't refer to the proletariat yet. He doesn't refer to the working class in the woods. He refers to the elemental class of society. And I've just begun to think about what that means, the elemental class. That is, surely that brings us right to the subject of reproduction, the reproduction of society. Where would we be without dinner tonight? Where would we be without children? Where would the future be without children? It would not exist. So the elemental class is that class which, I was going to say, lies at the foundation, as a fundament to all of human life.
This is Patricia Kohlberg, and you are tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm interrupting our programming to remind our listeners that if you are not a member of KBOO, now's a great time during our fall fundraising drive to sign up and become a monthly contributor. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio for free and given voice to many of the diverse communities that make up our city. Please help keep that fresh fruit of music and news and commentary coming off the vine of community radio. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or click on donate in your KBOO mobile app. Now for the conclusion of Sasha Lilly's discussion with Peter Limbaugh.
Well, staying with how these ideas located themselves within Marxist thinking, as we've been discussing, the awareness of the enclosure of the commons was foundational to Marx. He returned to the question of the commons much later in life. How did he see the commons in wrestling with a notion of life after capitalism? I mean, Marx famously said that we shouldn't write recipes for the cookshops of the future. And yet, we do have some notion of what life after capitalism hinted at for him. Tell us about how he returned to the question of the commons in the end of his life.
He did so not theoretically at first. He did so as was his habit throughout life. He did so by study. And what one of his teachers was Lewis Henry Morgan, who had spent so much time with the League of the Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois people of New York, and its five nations. It was from that work, that study, that he began to see how the defeat of women under patriarchy was a foundation of his civilization. Both he and Engels came to this conclusion after studying Lewis Henry Morgan. So then he also took up the study of the Russian language so that he could read firsthand accounts of the different forms of commoning that existed in Russia with the Mir and the Obshchina, two forms of the agrarian commons or village life in pre-capitalist Russia. It's interesting, you know, that at a time that Kropotkin was studying the commons, the time that William Morris was in Iceland studying the commons, Karl Marx was doing the same. And this, again, is at this crucial moment of the 1871 and the Paris Commune. Then he also began to collect information about commoning in Ireland. So Ireland, Algeria, Russia, and what we call New York State or the Iroquois were, I think, the four social formations that interested him in the last years of his life and to which he applied his mental faculties, which indeed were tremendous for language, for absorbing knowledge, for his powers of abstraction and generalization, and his command of detail. So that's the first step, you know, is study. And secondly, you're quite right, he wasn't into building a program of a communist future. He wasn't a what we might call a policy wonk, nor was he just a dreamer. He believed that commoning or communism was already here in forms that we hardly recognize, that we barely recognize, generally as forms of mutuality. I mean, he said this even as a young man with Engels in the German ideology. He said that communism is the real movement of things. And he thought it was all around him. And regardless of how we think, I think as a general methodological principle, it's often true that people don't see the commons until it's removed. You know, until there's no longer a sidewalk in your neighborhood, you don't realize that walking along the street was once, that streets were made for pedestrians. Or, you know, walking down the hall in school, there was a water fountain. You don't realize that you have to bring your own water or buy it until those water fountains are removed. So this is the way I see that principle when Marx says that communism is the real movement around us. But now we're creating new types of movement. He does have a notion in the critique of the Gotha program of a principle for communism, which is, as everyone knows, or if they don't know, we should certainly learn, that from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs, as a social principle. And of course, this principle has other roots. We can find it in other traditions, you know, whether it's Jewish, Muslim, Christian, or Hindu, or Parsi, I was going to say. From each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. Just as a handy way of describing what communism is and differentiating it from capitalism. He also had a notion, you know, of a dictatorship of the proletariat, by which he meant not so much the destruction. He meant he wanted us to see that the capitalist class was not consistent with that slogan, from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. And therefore, it had to, its basis had to be removed. That's what was meant by the dictatorship of the proletariat. He believed that we lived under a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. And it's easy, I think, for us to see that in some of our rulers and their tremendous wealth, but also as we look around to their means of rule, whether it's the Silicon Valley, publishing, internet, it's also based on huge amounts of wealth that are, and not just the wealth of labor, but the wealth of nature, you know, of the amount of water that's taken to produce our computers, for example, the amount of oil from underground that enables cities to run. All of these are also forms of horrendous exploitation of nature that is equal to, parallel with, inseparable from the exploitation of one another, of one class of people by another class of people, as most people understand Marx correctly, as a person who saw the class struggle as being the basis of human life, and that had to go, had to change.
Peter Leinbach, I wonder if you could talk more about how Marx's thinking was shaped by the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederation. There has been, I think, renewed attention, partially through the work of David Graeber, of the influence of Native communist egalitarian thought on the more egalitarian aspects of Enlightenment thinking. But as you note, for Marx and for Engels, the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee were quite important in terms of shaping their understanding of some key parts of how we should understand class society. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the debt that communist ideas have to that.
Yes, that's a really important question. I mean, it's an important task to answer that question. How did indigenous experience affect communist ideas? But I think also I would like to add on to that challenge, how did indigenous practices affect communist practices? That is, how did indigenous people, like David Graeber and David Wengrow in their book, they talk about Kondiaronk, a Huron or Wyandotte person who in the 1690s was a diplomat and aristocrat of indigenous people here in Ontario and Michigan, and who had a deep criticism of private property, was ashamed that people would lock one another up. That is, he was deeply against imprisonment. He was against class societies, such as he saw when he, Kondiaronk, went to France. A similar trajectory is true of Joseph Brant, the Seneca chief and leader, who also had a criticism of private property, of the manners and forms of punishment, the cruelty and the greed of the conquerors that came from France or England. They affected, as Graeber and Wengro show, Enlightenment thinking. And how that worked needs to be more deeply explored than it has been heretofore. But also we need to see how did the encounters of indigenous people, African people, people from Europe, from the working classes of Europe to the working classes of the Caribbean. This took place on shipboard, and I think here's where Melville shines a light on it and invites us to explore with him that the ship itself was a place where the peoples of the continents communicated. It's not just that they made possible communications of the continents, but the people also on the ship were from all over the place. So internationalism begins on the ship. And then I think also there's historians are discovering more and more what anthropologists used to call tri-isolate communities, that is maroon communities, where people from Europe, Africa, and Native Americans would consort and within a generation or two produce a new kind of human being, a new kind of person. And this is what comes to my mind right away, Sasha, is a wonderful story of the leader of the Great Irish Rebellion of 1798, who was so talented and so wonderful in many ways. I mean, he took off his wig and put on his head instead the red cap of liberty when he was having dinner with Thomas Paine in Paris. This guy, the Brits had him assassinated early on in the rebellion of 1798 because he was such a commander and could command forces, you know, as a great general. But the thing that influenced him so much was a notion of federation of Protestants, Anglicans, Catholics, pagan people in Ireland, a federation of these. And he learned about federation as a practical matter from his companion, Tony Small, who was an African-American. And they together went to the headwaters of the Mississippi and to Michilimackinac. I love saying that name. I'm not native to Michigan, but when I first heard Michiganders speak of Michilimackinac, I didn't know how to say it or where it was. But it's the strait that joins Lake Michigan with Lake Huron, and it's very close to another strait joining Lake Superior to Lake Huron. Michilimackinac was, of course, a fundamental fort for the European conquest, but it's here that that they ran into Native people who wanted to initiate them to a new kind of person. And so they gave Lord Edward Fitzgerald a new name, and that name was Eggendahl. And I like to think of him, you know, and they say revolutions produce new kinds of people. And this was, you know, like in 1788 or 89, I forget just when, but it's right on the verge of the worldwide revolution that culminated in Haiti, began in France. But here we have an Irishman, an African-American, and an Iroquois, a Seneca person, joining in alliance at Michilimackinac. I keep saying that name because that's where Conde Ronk, you know, the Graeber's interlocutor for indigenous ways, that's where he was, that's where he spoke, that same conjuncture of Great Lakes and of the Great Waters, which are being now, I must say, being protected by the women of the Ginaway Collective in those same waters against their pollution by the Enbridge Corporation, which produces millions of dollars, but more to the point is produces huge amounts of poison and waste, endangering the land and the waters of the Great Lakes.
Peter Linebaugh, thank you so much for joining me. It's been such a pleasure having you on.
Sasha, yeah, you're welcome. It's wonderful to be with you and your listeners.
Peter Linebaugh is the author of many books, including The London Hanged and Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that I have a connection to PM Press, which published that book. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
That concludes our show for today. Our gratitude goes out to Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song for allowing us to share their interviews with you and to the hardworking staff at KBOO. It's only on your community radio station that you're going to hear a discussion like you just did. So please, if you can, send your support our way by donating to KBOO, or better yet, by becoming a sustaining member. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or click on Donate in your KBOO mobile app. And thanks to everyone who has donated generously in the past to keep community radio alive in Portland. I'm Patricia Colbert, and I've been your host for the hour. Catch us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for our special programming to honor Indigenous Peoples Day. Thanks for listening.